Support for 51% comes from the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Bard College, offering master's degrees and teacher certification in 1 year, graduate study and extensive public school residencies combined with small class sizes, and a focus on the learner as an individual. Now accepting applications, Teaching What Matters, bard.edu/mat/ny.
On this week's 51%, we reflect on old times and new. First, we meet two women from World War II. We hear about a petition to award a suffragist with a presidential honor. And a West Coast priest hopes her program for homeless hospitality serves as a model.
So churches are in a unique position because as part of our religious activity is hospitality. And so part of that hospitality is allowing people to park on our property.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
When he's up there in the sky, ask any army pilot, and he'll answer with a sigh. While I'm there in the air with my head in the clouds, I think of someone I love. And I know down below she is thinking of me.
During World War II, some 350,000 women served in the U.S. Armed Forces, both at home and abroad. Records show that by the time the war was over, more than 2 million women had worked in war industries. Some volunteered as nurses or members of home defense units, while others enlisted as full-time members of the military. Two women of the greatest generation from upstate New York speak with 51%'s Dave Lucas about the roles they played during the war.
The Second World War involved global conflict on an unprecedented scale. 1940s Americans were consumed by nationalism, determined to resist Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany. Ruth Leeson served with the U.S. Marine Corps.
My name in the service was Sergeant Ruth Horton.
Leeson originally wanted to be a nurse, but her mother forbid it. She was in the first graduating class of Columbia High School in June 1941. The Albany-born Leeson took a job working with her uncle at a flight school in Troy.
The president of RPI came over one day, and he said, as the time goes down for the war, he said, I'd like to put an instrument program in here.
Her uncle called technology pioneer, inventor Ed Link, and became discouraged when he found he couldn't afford to purchase one of Link's teaching units.
So I just looked at him and I said, I'll get it for you, Bob. I didn't know what a Link was, anything about it, what it did, or anything else.
Leeson's curiosity helped her find a way. She joined the Marines in 1943, determined to get to know the Link inside out, studying at Link Instructor School in Atlanta.
The pilots knew how to fly by instruments. But in order to get their flight pay, they had to be reviewed every 4 months because they get off on their own ways of doing things.
Leeson became an aerial navigation instructor, well-versed in the use of the Link simulator, a key pilot training aid which taught flyers the art and science of celestial navigation. More than 500,000 American pilots were trained on the Link. Now 94, Leeson, who retired from VA hospital after fulfilling a childhood dream of becoming a nurse, remembers her commandant wouldn't allow the women in her unit to travel overseas, something that never stopped her from giving her all to helping out the war effort. She says the schooling she received and the friends she made changed her life forever and for better. Across the Atlantic Ocean, the British home front was a stark contrast to Leeson's experience here. 96-year-old Cecily Garrity was 21 when she signed up to serve a 5-year stint in the Royal Air Force in Great Britain. She assisted in providing care to RAF pilots.
I was with the Bomber Command. I was there for the pilots going in and out for battle.
She was shuffled to several bases or points of operation, ultimately ending up at a base called Sealand.
It was next town to Chester, and I was there for most of the time then. Our mission was to take care of the pilots. We had to work all different shifts to be with them when they came back from battle or going out. And many a pilot never came back. And that was sad to see, you know. There was one pilot, his wife had a baby, and he went to the bar, and he got drunk. Nobody saw him go to the airfield. He took a plane up and never came back. I always remember that.
Garrity witnessed many of the sorrows of war, both away and when she went home one day on leave, only to find her neighborhood had been bombed by the Germans. Soldiers escorted her past barricades.
When I was going down that road to get to my house, I was tripping over dead bodies.
Walking past bomb craters and the smoldering ruins of buildings, she was astonished to find that her family home was one of the few still standing.
All our windows were blown out, but we had a Morrison shelter in the dining room, which we slept. My family of five girls and my mother and father slept in that Morrison shelter, which eight people could lie down in.
The Morrison shelter was almost as common as an ironing board in English households. It was an indoor cage that was designed to protect the occupants from masonry and debris if the home was hit by a bomb. Garrity recalls how British civilians, her friends, and neighbors suffered.
I came from a town of Birkenhead, and there was Liverpool. It was just shattered. There was so many places in England that they'll never forget that war. And I hope to God that it never breaks out here, because they really don't know what we went through.
While stationed at Sealand, Garrity met her future husband, Michael, an Irishman who emigrated to England as a teenager. He had received papers to reunite with family who had settled in America. Garrity joined him a year later by working as a nanny with a family who paid her passage to the States. She and Michael eventually put down roots in upstate New York. Leeson also married and returned to the area. Her memories of wartime are still strong, and she's appreciative of the life and times she experienced.
During a war, it's a 50-50 proposition. If it wasn't for the home front, they'd get 50% of the 100. We get the other 50 because they are our supporters and our suppliers, the whole nine yards. So I thank the home front.
Leeson continues to serve her community, giving 100% through volunteer work at the VA hospital in Albany. For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
Support continues to grow for President Obama to award a suffragist with ties to the Hudson Valley a Presidential Citizens Medal. More than 1,000 groups and individuals have signed the campaign's petition for the New York native and Vassar College graduate to be the recipient. Candidates are nominated for the Presidential Citizens Medal, which recognizes Americans who have performed exemplary deeds of service for their country or their fellow citizens. It is the second highest civilian award in the U.S. The Presidential Medal of Freedom is the first. With 2016 marking the centennial of suffragist Inez Milholland's death, supporters such as Marguerite Kern say the timing is right in a women's history story that continues.
It's really another milestone in a very long process. It started in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, and it's continuing to the present day, and it moves into the future. It's a long-term story.
The petition supporting the nomination of Milholland has been submitted to the White House for consideration. Kearns credits filmmaker Martha Wheelock with helping to circulate Milholland's story. Earlier in 2016, Wheelock produced and distributed Forward Into Light, a documentary about Milholland.
Well, she's one of those unsung heroes that we should know. The most famous suffrage icon you never heard of, I always say. She's best known for the image that she presented in 1913 on a white horse leading the biggest suffrage march in Washington, D.C., where 8,000 women demanded their right to vote.
1913, Washington, D.C., the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. A massive spectacle of 8,000 women displaying their demand for the right to vote. The peaceful, dignified, colorful march is suddenly interrupted.
Men spat upon the women, slapped them in the face, tripped them, pelted them with cigar stubs, pulled them off floats, tore off their skirts, and cursed them. New York Times.
Now there appears a gallant figure out of the pressing throngs, a girl in white upon a white horse, dressed in flowing crusader's cloak, Inez Milholland. She courageously parts the way through the hordes of men and drives an opening for the marchers to continue. Hazel McKay.
2017 denotes the centennial of women securing the right to vote in New York, and 2020 the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. Kearns is co-chair of the nonprofit National Women's History Project, Inez Milholland Centennial Campaign. She says Milholland, who was born in Brooklyn in 1886, was a Vassar College graduate some 60 years before the Poughkeepsie-based college became co-ed.
The first rumblings for Inez Milholland happened when she was a student in the Hudson Valley shortly before her graduation from Vassar in 1909. And she was popular, she was an athlete, she was opinionated, and she got into trouble because the president of Vassar didn't want women talking about voting rights on campus. And so that was her first launching into the public arena.
Milholland went to New York University School of Law and practiced law in the city while advocating for women's voting rights. Kearns' grandmother knew Milholland.
My grandmother, Edna Kearns, knew Inez Milholland, and she knew, of course, a lot of different individual activists in New York State. And New York is the cradle of the women's rights movement in the United States. It wasn't a large group of people, but they worked hard. My grandmother worked from, I'd say, 1910 to 1920, and she was associated with all the different state and regional and national organizations. At the very end, she picketed the White House with Alice Paul and the National Women's Party. And the Sewell Belmont House, which is now renamed the Belmont Paul National Monument in Washington, D.C., was the headquarters. And so in 2017, in January, the picketing of the White House started 100 years ago. So it's really a very rich legacy that we have, and Inez Milholland is an important part of it. And by recognizing Inez, we're recognizing a broad segment of American women and men. My grandfather marched in the suffrage parades in New York City and Washington, D.C., along with my grandmother and my aunt Serena, who was about, maybe when she was 10 years old, riding in the wagon and going from place to place with her mother. She was a suffrage movement child and a suffrage poster child. And in those days, it was very unusual to take your child on such grueling trips, but she did it.
And Kearns points out there is a Christmas Day legacy here. On Christmas in 1916, more than 1,000 women and men gathered in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol for a memorial service for Milholland. It was the first time a woman was honored there. After refusing to cancel a speaking tour for the 19th Amendment in 1916, Milholland collapsed. Here's more from Wheelock's documentary.
President Wilson, how long must women wait for liberty?
In the middle of this intense sentence, this remarkable woman crumpled up like a wilted white rose and lay stark upon the platform. Los Angeles Times.
Inez Milholland dies 3 weeks later in Los Angeles at the tender age of 30.
Milholland, a founding member of the National Woman's Party, was buried near the family home in Lewis in the Adirondacks. As we experience the shortest days of the year, we take a look at the therapeutic aspects of daylight. One researcher found that light therapy dramatically improves symptoms in patients with dementia. This comes with the backdrop of several studies saying a higher percentage of women suffer from dementia than men. Lilia Fukin reports.
Some characteristics of dementia are depression, memory loss, agitation, and detachment from social interaction. But what if some of these symptoms could be relieved by exposure to a specific kind of light? Lisa Onega, a professor in the School of Nursing at Radford University, led a study that tried to answer this question.
We took about 60 individuals who had different levels of dementia, and exposed them to light therapy, and evaluated them on depression and agitation.
All 60 patients were living in long-term care facilities. 30 were given the placebo light, and 30 were given the specific bright light that mimics daylight. And they were evaluated over a period of 8 weeks.
And we found that agitation actually increased in the control group or in the group that didn't get bright light, and depression stayed about the same. But our results show that if they were exposed to bright light, their depression dramatically decreased, as well as their agitation.
The setup was designed to mirror a sunny day outside.
It ended up being really beautiful. We put a tree on either side of the light, and we put a bush in front of it.
And the patients who got the bright light were functioning better. They were more engaged. Not only did the study show definitive results, but feedback from patients' families was positive.
We were wrapping up our project at one of our sites, and I was collecting all of our lights and our trees, etc. And a family member came over to me and said, "I don't know whether my loved one was in the bright light or placebo light study, but since you started your study, our loved one is talking, engaged, social, not agitated. We love this study." And it was really fabulous to have that kind of feedback from family members who didn't really know which group their member was in, but felt that our intervention was significant.
Lisa says that with older dementia patients, healthcare providers are often dealing not only with dementia, but with a whole host of health issues, from cardiovascular disease to diabetes.
If we can decrease the use of antidepressants or some of the antipsychotic and other medications used to help with agitation, it would be amazing, because it would be good from a financial perspective for society, but it would be good from a clinical perspective because it would reduce side effects and other potential interactions with medication. So it has quality of life and quantity of life implications.
Lisa says that this research now warrants a much larger study that includes other variables. But in the meantime, what if someone wanted to try this light therapy on their own?
If they feel that it makes a difference, I would ask them to be prudent with anything they do and evaluate cost, evaluate the safety. We have found no studies that show that there is a safety problem, but that's something that I think we have to monitor, because this is so early that we don't know for sure. So I think as long as they're prudent and don't just implement something and not evaluate it, I think that would be great.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
This news out of Iowa: a former Drake University student has sued the university, claiming it discriminated against him by failing to consider his allegations of sexual assault by a female student, but believing her allegations against him. The case centers on a night of drinking in October 2015. The university determined the male student made his allegations against the woman in retaliation for her complaint. But the man's lawsuit says the university never investigated his claims. The lawsuit alleges violations of John Doe's constitutional due process rights and federal sex discrimination laws. The university says it disagrees with his depictions of the facts and will prove its commitment to fairness. It's among several recent lawsuits claiming federal guidance pushing aggressive pursuit of campus sexual assaults has resulted in bias against men. More and more people are being priced out of their homes these days. Combine that with a hangover from the 2008 recession, the income gap is bigger than ever, and people have a harder time finding financial help and services. The face of homelessness is changing in ways that are not easily addressed by any one group or agency. More people have resorted to living in their vehicles, but that's a tough life, filled with challenges, of course. In Washougal, Washington, a young woman priest at a small church has invited some of these car campers to stay until they can find more stable housing. Barb Seaman brings us the story.
If you drive down Main Street in Washougal, Washington, you might think St. Anne's Episcopal Church looks like an old-fashioned little country parish. But just like in nearby Portland, there are people here struggling to cope with modern-day problems.
So I lost the place I was living and didn't have anywhere to go. I ended up in my car.
That's Joanna. She grew up just outside of town and has a long history of depression and addiction. She's been homeless since this past June.
I don't know, I just kind of parked and hid out from people. There was a park down by the river too, but I found out you can't park there at night.
We're hanging around next to our old Ford Explorer in the parking lot behind the church. It's a cool autumn day, and Joanna wears a baseball hat and a plaid barn coat over pink sweatpants.
It's not a fun way to live. I'd avoid it at all costs.
Her car is filled up, packed with everything she has, even her cat.
But I can't imagine not having him in the car with me, because it would be so lonely. I have back here my coolers. I have two coolers that I take out. And I have two couch cushions that are that way to sleep on. And yeah, my fan for my heater won't work right now, so it gets really cold sometimes.
While she slogs through the process of trying to find long-term inpatient care, Joanna is staying at St. Anne's. She's part of their Safe Car Camping program. It gives homeless people living out of their cars a connection to a caring community, but more importantly, it gives them a safe and legal place to park.
There are many beautiful parks that you can park in, but if you were there sleeping overnight, the police would come, knock on your window, and tell you to wake up and leave.
That's Reverend Jesse Smith, who became vicar here right out of seminary 4.5 years ago. She started the program last year.
People can come in at 5 p.m., and they can park until 9 a.m. in the morning.
This is a little peace garden. It has a little arbor people sit in and smoke or hang out, and it's a little meditative. You can look out over the field. And so this is our play yard. We used to have a preschool that was here at St. Anne's, but we don't anymore. But it gave us this great opportunity.
Jesse said yesterday that we're doing a potluck, so.
From 5 to 7, we open our building, and people can come in and use our kitchen and the bathrooms and just hang out, get warm.
If it wasn't for the white clerical collar, you might not realize at first that she's a priest. Reverend Smith is a young woman, tattooed, pierced, rides a motorcycle. She has an unconventional history and a fresh perspective. She says St. Anne's took a leap of faith when they brought her here.
They trusted that they wanted to grow and do something different, and they didn't quite know what that was, and I didn't know what that was either because I'd never done this before. I came from a background where, I lived in a Christian anarchist community, and the way that the highest value of Christianity was to live out hospitality. So churches are in a unique position because as part of our religious activity is hospitality. And so part of that hospitality is allowing people to park on our property. 20.
The church has hosted 20 cases in its first year. Some stay longer than others. Some are families with small children. There's even one woman who's been here since the beginning. And while the need keeps growing, so does the program.
And here's the closet we'll convert into a shower here, and then a stacking washer, dryer, and then a scrub sink here. And we've had issues come up with drugs and prostitution and things like messy lives bring, but the biggest challenge is unearthing and realizing as a community that there is so little for so many of these people here. There aren't housing programs that people will get into, maybe not even before they die.
I'm very grateful to them. How else would I have a stove?
So St. Anne's just keeps the focus on offering hospitality, hoping to improve the quality of life for a handful of people who need it the most.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus has its first female ringmaster. Feld Entertainment is the parent company of the Florida-based circus. The company said in a statement that Kristen Michelle Wilson will be the first ever female ringmaster in its 146-year history. Wilson's role begins in the new year in her first performance in her hometown of Orlando, Florida. She will become the 39th ringmaster in Ringling Brothers history. Wilson has a professional background in theater and singing. A ringmaster typically introduces each act in the circus. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1432.